Do you think about making dance beats? I mean, because your music, it's obviously remixed and sampled forever, but were you thinking at the time, these are just great grooves?
We did start out like that a little bit because we had a group of friends that we used to go to clubs with. This is sort of post-punk, and everybody was trying to find something where it was Fad Gadget or it was David Bowie or it was Roxy Music or whatever where they were playing in the club, but it was looking for something that you could move to and dance to that wasn't just disco.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in the beginning, yeah, we kind of were trying to make music for our friends.
And now you have 30 million friends.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, this is Glenn from home, depeche-mode.com, and welcome to episode 11 of Breathing in Fumes. I have a very special guest joining me on this episode, and I'm thrilled to welcome Andy Harriman to the podcast. She's a writer, DJ, promoter, and a goth scholar from New York, and some of you might be familiar with her from her book Somewhere Leather, Somewhere Lace, which focused on the goth and post-punk culture of the 80s. She's also a contributing writer to post-punk.com and has written for The Village Voice, Noisy, Bandcamp, Electronic Beats, and many more. I wanted to reach out to her to get a little more insight on how Depeche's music appeals to fans of goth music. Depeche's music in general sometimes might feel or seem a little too poppy compared to some of the other bands embraced by the goth community. So she was kind enough to answer my questions and give us some perspective on how Depeche fits in. She also gave us some background on the music in general, post-punk, and much, much more. One thing I want to point out that we didn't hear during our conversation were some sound issues that I tried to clean up the best I could, but you can still hear some static in our conversation. It's not that bad, but it could be a little distracting at times, so I hope it doesn't ruin it for you because she gave some great insight that's worth hanging in there for. Now, we recorded this episode a few months back, but I wanted to save it to get 2019 off to a great start. So with all that said, let's get into it. Okay, hey Andy, how you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
Good, good. Well, thank you for being on the podcast. It's you know, there's some things I'd like to go over that I'd love your insight on, so I really appreciate you coming and talking with me today.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, God, I'm so bad at these things, so bear with me as I But, you know, ultimately what I'd like to get into is here where Depeche Mode kind of fits in the goth world, and I couldn't think of anyone better to reach out to than you, you know, and what you know, your input, I think, would help a lot of Depeche Mode fans maybe realize where they fit in there too, because they seem to fit in everywhere and nowhere at the same time. So, you know, growing up, I knew a lot of goths, and I was a big fan of the music, still am. And whenever we would talk music, they would talk about bands that sounded nothing like Depeche Mode at all, yet they were all Depeche fanatics.
And like what?
Well, you know, they would talk about, I mean, probably the more accessible stuff like Sisters and mm-hmm. whatever, Alien Sex Fiend or whatever, and all these bands that were more aggressive. And then here's Depeche Mode. It's not like they were going, oh, I love Erasure and Red Flag, you know? It's like, so it's, I guess I kind of wanted to dig into a little more about how they appealed to that audience as well. Aside, you know, I get it, the lyrics and the dark imagery and some of that, but at the end of the day, they kind of made pop music. They still do, but I mean, especially in the 80s. And so I kind of wanted to dig a little into that. But before we get into that, I'd love to hear a little more about your synthesize party that you do there in New York. How did that get going?
Yeah, that was, well, my 5-year anniversary is coming up in January.
Awesome.
Of next year, actually. So I'm pretty excited about that. Yeah, synthesize started, well, I moved to New York in 2012, December 2012. And then a year later, after going to parties, and I realized that everything was so separated. Like, there was an industrial club, there was, you know, and they didn't play, like, dark synth or goth or anything. And then there was, you know, techno, which didn't, you know, I'm very specific about my techno that I like, but I do blame Martin's DJ sets on why I like techno. That was the first time I've ever heard techno.
Oh.
Was at playing the Angel Tour. You know how Martin does those, like, techno sets at the beginning of the show?
Yeah. Yeah, the little warm-ups.
Like, yeah. And I was like, okay, I can get into this. So, you know, I'm a little selective about techno, but then you have the techno scene in one place, and you have the industrial in the other, which is, like, I was really into new beat at the time. I mean, I still am, but I was obsessed. And it was industrial and new beat on one side, then the goth in the other, and then the techno in the other. And I was just like, why, you know, and everything was so, like, you have to dress a certain way, be a certain way. And I kind of was just like, I want to combine all of these things and make a party where people don't feel judged, don't feel pressure to look a certain way or to enjoy just a specific type of music. So it started out as a Sunday happy hour at Bossa Nova Civic Club in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And, yeah, it was from, like, I don't know, 7 to 10 p.m. on Sunday nights for a year. And then they graduated me to Thursday nights from, you know, 10 to 4 a.m. So I've been at that club for 5 years now. And, yeah, it worked really well. I think people at the time, 5 years ago, people didn't really blend things. Like, techno wasn't into the industrial EBM stuff like Nights of Reb, but, you know, through the years, it kind of became popular again, playing like Nights of Reb and 242 and DJ sets. But at the time, nobody was doing that. And I've been, you know, cultivating that for a few years.
It's interesting to hear how it was separate, because I'm a little older, so I hate to be that, I'm a little older, but I just remember when I started getting into it and going to clubs, it was like a natural progression. You know, there was the alternative dance remixes, kind of started getting into techno, industrial, it all was kind of merging at that, like, 88 to 91 range. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, that's interesting that a club might not, it would make sense to play, you know, all of it, because it's all kind of a melting pot. So I mean they have a specific thing they were going for, so I get that, but it's just how related it all is kind of interesting that they would separate things.
Yeah, I agree. I really didn't like that. I felt that if it's good music, it should all be played together.
Yeah.
I think people started catching on again, but for a while things were very everything was in its own little box, which I didn't really appreciate.
So at on that night specific at Synthesize, what are you playing, like old school industrial, or do you blend the generations from now to like the techno that's kind of related to it that has that edge? Is it kind of all are you throwing in synth pop and new wave, or is it just out of
Well, it depends on my DJs. I have special annual nights. Like, one night I have an 80s synth night, but then I'll also have an industrial, I call it summer camp, which is from 7 p.m. to 4 a.m., so it's, like, all industrial, any kind of industrial music. But on normal nights, it depends on who I book, but it's usually, when I DJ, it's a blend of old industrial. Maybe I'll throw in like a Stacey Q song here and there, you know, something nice. Light at the end of the night. But usually it's pretty dark up until the end. So it's mostly dark music of all decades. I wouldn't say that there's any specific. I mean, there's an emphasis on the 80s because I'm obsessed with that. But
yeah, me too.
Yeah, I do both.
Do you how does Depeche go down when you know, I'm sure the crowd, you have a lot of regulars and then you have your tourists and people coming, you know, rotating through. Does Depeche Mode come up often on a night like that? I would think with the word synth in it, they would.
yeah, always. I mean, you have, everybody goes crazy for Behind the Will and Strangelove.
Yeah.
Also, I really like, there's a remix of Get the Balance Right. Which remix is that? I'm trying to remember.
Is it the combination mix? The
yes.
Official?
Yes, oh, that yeah. one. That one always goes over really, really well.
Oh, yeah.
I like to mix that one in, too. Yeah, like sometimes when it's the right moment, people be, you know, do a little scream or yelp about their excitement.
Yeah, that's so cool. Is there a moment, I don't know, I had this moment with, like, when I was DJing heavily, you know, and I slipped Depeche Mode in. It was always fun to see who would react, you know, because I'd be playing a certain format, and then it's like I might have a house remix of a Depeche track, and I'd slide it in, and you see who's way into them, you know, and other people just kind of keep going along, and then you see the Depeche fans. That was always really fun for me. But I'd be playing on nights where, you know, it'd be like house music nights, not necessarily an industrial night where you might hear that. But that's what's interesting with me, to me, about Depeche Mode, is how a night like that, if you would, it would be okay if you heard it, or, and if you didn't hear it, you know, it was just, there's, it's just such a, the appeal is crazy. And how did that music, how did you find this music in your, musical journey, I guess, to sound kind of, I don't know, your path, you know, I'm not that obnoxious, but no, I'm always interested on how people find their passions, you know. I think I saw an interview where Depeche was one of the first bands that kind of set you on that defining your music.
Oh yeah. Well, my obsession with the 80s definitely came from my childhood and just listening to soft rock radio, because my parents were super religious and wouldn't let me listen to anything else.
Oh yeah.
It was like, that's the only option. So I was listening to like the 80s soft rock, you know, the poppy, like Phil Collins, Genesis sort of thing.
But Air Supply, then I'm right there with you.
Yeah. all that stuff. It was, it's all good. I like it now. But then one day I saw Robert Smith on TV and I just fell in love. And yeah. So I went and bought his Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me at the CD store, used version. Nice. And then I guess doing a little research, I saw Music for the Masses. So I went and bought that used at a CD store. And that was just kind of the end of the beginning. You know, it was like, that was exactly what I've always wanted to hear my whole life. And it finally came to me. And
Oh, that's so cool.
Started it all.
Nice. What bands, maybe in the goth kind of sound from that era, were the first few bands you heard?
Well, I would say probably Joy Division.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I bought Substance. That was a really good album. And then I guess it went to
maybe Bauhaus. The Cure. Oh, Bauhaus.
Well, yeah, The Cure, if you want to count, like, Disintegration and stuff, all of that, very important. But then more, you know, Bauhaus and probably Joy Division were two bands that soon followed after that.
I know. I remember I got Head on the Door, and I the term goth, the idea of goth, I had no idea. I was, you know, I just didn't know. But and then I remember getting that record and just being like, wow, this is so different. His voice compared to... You know, I was still finding my music in 84, 85, but I was buying People Are People did it for me. And then I got Some Great Reward, and then Aha and ABC and Thompson Twins, all the accessible stuff that a 12, 13 year old could find. And then I went to a cool record store, and a lady was so excited I was into these bands, and she turned me on to like The Cure. And I think I remember hearing Dead Can Dance. No. She turned me on to Dead Can Dance, but it was some of the more obscure stuff, especially at the time, like 4AD bands. And and I remember just going, whoa. And it was so different, you know? And so, yeah. It's just, that kind of sucked me in. And it sounds like it did for you as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I think Depeche Mode has that very sad, epic sounds that if you have a melancholic personality, you're just very attracted to it. And I think they help, like Depeche Mode kind of helped me realize that there is music that, you know, reflects how I feel.
Yeah,
and
for
so
sure.
So I just kept digging further and further. So I'd say Depeche Mode is the reason why I'm into any of this.
Yeah, me too. I got attracted to the melodies and the electronics yes. and all the textures and layers. And that made me fall in love with electronic music. And mm-hmm. I got into Depeche through fascination of electronics. And I've talked to people who've got into them from so many different areas. I don't even, you know, if it was the, you know, like you were saying, like more the melancholy kind of vibe to it or the electronics or just the complete alternative to, you know, something like Phil Collins or some of the bands you were mentioning. Lionel Richie, I remember like that was on the radio and then I heard People Are People. I was like, whoa. So, yeah, I guess everyone finds it. It's what keeps you there, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's why, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself. How did you get into DJing? You know, it's interesting when I talk to DJs because sometimes they got into it from falling in love with music or actually falling in love with playing music. So did you have any interest in making music after you fell in love with it, or did DJing come from that?
I had a couple bands. One band I was doing in 2012, I'm not even going to say the name because it's so embarrassing, but it was based on sort of more high-tech AOR kind of music. I don't know if you're familiar with that kind of music, but it's...
Adult-oriented rock.
But it's high-tech, so it's not just guitars. It's a lot of synth work, like really beautiful synth work. Mm. It wasn't a spoof to us. We were very serious about it, but if anybody else heard or saw us, they would be like, wow, these people are spoofing 80s stuff.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I was kind of going down this, like, you know, I've always collected records and everything, and I was really researching new beat and very obscure industrial music. And I downloaded, maybe like in 2013, I downloaded a little tractor program on my phone and I recorded a mix on a train ride somewhere. And it actually turned out pretty good. And I realized that I understand, like, I think it's kind of important that people understand, especially for industrial or songs with melodies, to be able to match the keys and, you know, kind of mix at the right time. And I realized that it kind of came natural for me.
A lot of musicians become amazing DJs just because they know song structure
yes.
and how they're going to sound. And for those who don't know what tractor is, it's a, how would you describe tractor? I mean, it's a software that you can DJ with, but it also, it's kind of like iTunes and you throw the songs into each turntable or CDJ or whatever you're playing on. And it's a way to play digital music on DJ equipment. So tractor, someone might be thinking like a tractor, you know, but it's,
oh yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So non DJs, tractors, a DJ software. So
yeah, it's really, I mean, you can download it on iTunes for your phone or the App Store for like $5 and like play around. It's really fun. But I kind of graduated from that and, I got some techniques and now I do some, you know, rec vinyl, but mostly I do CDJs.
Yep.
And it's kind of growing from there. My emphasis is not that much on new beat or, I do some industrial, but it's mostly EBM these days, I would say, you know, yeah. But some Depeche Mode tracks fit really well in there.
Oh yeah. Behind the wheel always kind of, you know, and I think you commented one time on social media, that's like your go-to Depeche jam in a DJ set. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Is that one of them?
I'm trying to find the version right now. And there's the Strangelove mix.
Tim Simonon.
Yeah, that one's really good. And I'm trying to... Oh, the Shep Pettibone Behind the Wheel.
Oh, that's that's a classic. Yeah, there's a DJ out of Europe. His name's Alcalino, and he just made a re-edit of that that's like super DJ friendly. And he gave I'll have to send it to you if you, I don't know if you have that one, but it's, Yeah, he gave it away as a free download, a wave of it, so it'll sound good in the club. But it's, yeah, I mean, that mix already is pretty DJ friendly, has a lot of intros and breaks, but yeah, I'll send it to you, but it's awesome. Yeah, that song you could play, you know, it's funny, I'll see Richie Houghton or Dave Clark or some of these big name guys, and they'll drop in Knights of Reb, and then they'll play like the original Behind the Wheel. You know, they'll just, and I always get so excited when I hear that, or what's his name, Ricardo Villalobos just played Strange Love recently. Just, I think it was a re-edit, but it was just cool that he played it, not some new version. So, well, yeah. And then are you playing, you're playing a lot of vinyl now in your DJ sets?
Not a lot. I just really hate carrying it around.
Yeah.
I will, because I like the obscurity of the vinyl that you can't find digitally. I really like playing stuff that people don't expect or have never heard. That's my favorite part about DJing, is letting other people experience new music.
Yeah, you see him Shazamming it. Like, what is that?
Yeah, you can't Shazam the stuff I play on vinyl.
I know. I always get on your Instagram stories, you'll show what records, and I was blown away that you had an album by the band Fake.
Oh God, they're my favorite.
Well, it took me so long to find the 12 inch for Brick, and when I play for people, they're like, "Oh, that's cool." I'm like, it's like, this is one of my favorite. Like, I guess they get lumped into a Italo disco, but it's synth for me.
And,
but you had like Celebrate the Nun. I just, all the stuff, I was like, oh man, that's probably a fun night.
Yeah, it's fun, but it's just a pain to carry around. Like,
yeah,
so hard.
It is. I remember the days before digital when I was lugging around crates. It was, and then you're always frayed all night because you're like, is there going to get drink spilled on my records? Or
yeah. And you're stressed because the record could skip if somebody hits the booth, you know, it's really stressful.
a funny story. I was DJing, had a full dance floor. It was one of my first DJ residencies, one of my first nights. And I was wearing a flannel, and I had for some reason, on the sleeve was unbuttoned. I didn't even think about it. It just, maybe I was going to roll it up and I didn't, I don't know how. And as I was reaching over to hit to adjust the pitch, the sleeve caught the needle and just pulled it up, and it did the whole chirp, 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 chirp. Oh, and no. It was like the whole floor was staring at me. I was like, it took about 4 or 5 songs to recover. Like, it really, like, or, you know, or ejecting before the, you know, like ejecting the CD that you're playing, you know, we've all done that stuff, but oh, that was awful. So
that's like what nightmares are made of.
Yeah, it was bad, you know, but luckily I just threw on I just put the song back on, and the next song, I can't even remember what it was. I was so shell-shocked from it, but I put on like something real popular that just kind of regroup. But yeah, I think everyone has that story. Now, I kind of, for people who might be listening to this that don't know the progression, and I know you're really, you know, especially from your book, and I don't want to bore you with, I'm sure you've done so much. We'll talk about the book, but you've done so much with that. But just quickly, for people who don't understand the progression of kind of how it went from punk to what post-punk, because Depeche took a lot of influence from post-punk. You know, David Bowie, kind of the king of that, kind of everything kind of seems to come back to Bowie. But, you know, maybe how to goth, and because, you know, some people just don't know the connection. You know, they got into it maybe at 3/4 of the way through and don't get, like, you know, it's alternative music now, but they don't kind of, can you kind of tell us a little bit about your, I don't know, I'm struggling here to make a point, so bear with me, but just, you know, how it went from punk to post-punk, and, you know, do you have a kind of the path?
Yeah. I can give it an abridged version. I do a whole lecture on this called Goth 101, and it's actually really
was the word I was looking for. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, punk was around in the late 70s as, you know, against everything that was going on, especially glam. It was just in your face, one, two, three, fuck the system sort of thing. And after a while, it became so mainstream that it was kind of a joke of itself.
Yeah.
So all the original punks were already out of punk, and everybody following it was just mainstream people. So two things happened. One is that a lot of people wanted something more beautiful and a little bit more melodic, and they wanted that back. And also technology at the time with synthesizers. Synthesizers were finally becoming more affordable.
Yeah.
So between the two, a lot of kids were getting together and just playing around with synthesizers, playing around with their gear and making, you know, music that was not in your face like punk was.
Wasn't as aggressive.
Exactly. And this was like, you know, it was between, I would say that post-punk started around 1977 and then grew through the early 80s. And then, you know, I think I would say through my research, I would say that because of the Batcave in London, which held bands like Specimen.
Was Batcave a club or was it a rock venue like CBGB's or something? Or was it both?
It was a small club. They had a dance floor, but they also had a place for bands to play. It was kind of like Danceteria. They had a stage, but they also had a floor to dance. And that's where goth was cultivated. So they took from post-punk with their atmosphere of synthesizers, and they took from glam with their looks, and then they also kind of emphasized horror B-movie films and that sort of you know, bats and graves and skulls. So yeah. All that together kind of cultivated what we now call goth. And you had Sex Gang Children, Southern Death Cult, all these bands. And then, yeah, Specimen, Alien Sex Fiend, all of those were very big Bat Cave bands. And then about 1980, I mean, Sisters of Mercy were around at that time, but I think they kind of finally came to be more popular in 1984 with their album First and Last and Always.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the beginning of the height of goth from 1984 to 1986, 87. And that's when bands started getting more popular, but they weren't super mainstream yet. You had Susie, you had The Cure, and also Depeche Mode, I would put in that category as well. They were kind of on the cusp. They were on MTV, but they weren't super, super big, you know. And then right. You had The Cult. And that's kind of what I like to call is like the death of goth, because when The Cult was She Saw Sanctuary, that's kind of when goth blew up. That's when it was everywhere.
Yeah.
And it kind of hit the it kind of just became too popular, and all the original goths were kind of just like punk was. They were just like, okay, this is way too popular. It's too easy to access the music that we, you know, love so much and look like a goth. Like before that, people had to make their own outfits. They were super creative about how they looked and what they listened to. But when it became more mainstream, they just had to, you could go to the store and buy something.
It was a natural rebellion. It wasn't like, oh, it's too cool, I'm out. It's just, these are the people who would move on as, because they liked being, I can't think of anything that's not cliche, like in the shadows or what. They liked being ahead of, you know, they moved on when things got too popular. You know, they just looked for the next, whatever that drew them in. So when would you say, I mean, goth's still going, but it's
it is.
It's depending on where you were in the world, I guess it had its ending, you know? Not ending, but it's original, you know, now it's just from the people who framed what it originally was, you know, the bands, the scenes, you know, now it's just kind of an extension of that. But when would you say that kind of ended, when the band's kind of, the music faded, you know?
Well, I think about it as right around 1986, 87 is when you really started with industrial music.
Right.
And that's when that's when I say the goth scene split. At that point, people who were really into electronic music went towards industrial, and the people who were really into rock music went towards like the more Western goth sounds, like Fields of the Nephilim, and also these like glam rocky bands such as Gene Loves Jezebel. So I feel like that's kind of when the scene started splitting, and it was very noticeable. You had 242 on one side, and then on the other side you had the Mission, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't related at all. Before then, all these bands worked together. You could have Sisters of Mercy with Depeche Mode and like all these different bands just working together at a club night. But then you wouldn't hear the Mission on the same night as Skinny Puppy. It just didn't make sense.
Right. Well, you know, yeah. I grew up an hour east of San Francisco, so I was always in San Francisco. And I don't know if we were more of a melting pot, but you know, and we had a really good, well, you had WLIR there in New York, but we had Live 105, LA had K-Rock, you know, what, but anyway, it was a pretty good melting pot of the scene, but it's interesting, back then it was a lot of blend, but now I'm friends with some DJs from that area, and they'll post their set lists, and it's just, it's so interesting what they're playing at goth clubs now versus back then. A lot of it's the same, but I don't know. I can't picture it divided because I grew up going to where the Mission and maybe 242 might have been played on the same night. But I guess that was, I missed it because I came later. You know, I came in the late 80s, early 90s. So maybe that happened prior to my experience for it. So I guess I'm projecting here. But yeah, that's interesting. And then when did, because I remember I started DJing in the height of industrial. Like I remember, and New Beat, like the late 80s. Like I was old enough to touch a little bit of the last remains of Acid House right before it was kind of turning into New Beat. But I remember hearing all those big techno anthems, and it was just all, so much was changing so fast then. I guess the same thing was happening on the goth side of things. I mean,
yeah. Like yeah, Zymox, I mean, I don't want to say that they didn't. I mean, I know goths that like some industrial, but I just kind of mean the direction that they weren't working together anymore.
Right.
It wasn't a blend of things. It was very much either guitars only or electronics only.
Interesting.
It wasn't this blend of different, you know, instruments and technologies. It was just kind of like either you're you're electronic or either you're mostly guitars.
Was there a resistance to, from your research, was there a resistance to like new wave that was the pretty poppy at the time?
No, I don't.
Like when I say new wave, I'm talking Thompson Twins and Thomas Dolby and you know, they all made great music, but you wouldn't think of them as goth. I mean, but were the goths not into them, or did it have to be a little bit heavier?
I didn't really ask them about that. I would say, I mean, if you go farther back in the early 80s, people weren't afraid to say they liked new romantic, like Visage and right. things like that. But I think maybe it became more taboo to admit.
Yeah.
Admit your love as the years went on, but early on people really loved the synth bubblegum synth stuff of new romantic
and the futurists, like Depeche Mode we're not new romantic, we're futurists, you know.
And yeah.
It's interesting when I look back at that history and how like over there where they were just, it all seemed like the same, they kind of looked the same, but they're like, you know, new romantics were rock bands with synthesizers. We're all synthesizers, you know, like, and New Order never really fit into that. And they were kind of doing that, but it's just interesting to see, like, as you're talking about this, Depeche Mode still crossed all those boundaries and fit true. In.
That's true.
Yeah, it's interesting how that worked out with them. Like, that's why I kind of wanted to get the goth perspective, because when I talk to goth DJs or see their track list, it'll be like all these bands that sound nothing like them, and then bam, you know, like Dangerous. You know, they play Dangerous in between, you know, Specimen and like you said, like a band like Fields of the Nephilim or something, and you just be like, but there's no other bands like them, like maybe being played that night. It's kind of interesting. I just was curious where New Wave fit in, because some of them, especially after the New Romantics, like the later stuff, you know, because Adamant, Bow Wow Wow, that first kind of wave, they all kind of, I guess they were more glammy?
Have you read Simon Reynolds' book, Rip It Up and Start It Again?
I haven't, no.
They include, you know, Adamant and Bow Wow Wow and everything in the post-punk section.
That makes sense to me, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good book. You should read it. It's an amazing book about everything. Post-punk is a really big umbrella of music, honestly.
For sure. I mean, you see Depeche Mode and the Smiths also included in that, you know, and some might say, oh, they're indie and they're electronic and, you know, but yeah, it is a big umbrella. That I think in my mind, sometimes I think goth is a bigger umbrella than it might be.
Yeah, I always put post-punk as the biggest umbrella in goth. I like to put goth, industrial, new wave, some new wave, and then... maybe there's a whole chapter on mute music, mute records in Simon Reynolds' book. He really breaks it down into every single genre. Some you're like, wow, this is post-punk music. I mean, this is his interpretation, of course, right. But he makes an argument for it. And it's basically any sort of underground music from 1978 to 1984.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense to me. And it's very British focused. They don't really talk about anything outside of Britain, but and he puts ABC in there. Interesting. And a lot of early industrial stuff like Cabaret Voltaire, Clock DBA, and then he has a whole section on Heaven 17.
Mm. So,
yeah.
That's interesting. Well, I know it's funny. I saw ABC a couple years ago, and Martin Fry comes out and you know, he's performing, and then he talks about, we were the New Romantics, because he's in his suit. And I was just like, I never thought of you guys as New Romantics, but okay. You're always more of a kind of a new wave. But I think the American perspective is a little different, because everything was really categorized like that. Like everything got lumped into new wave or metal or whatever. That's, you know, they had it so much better on radio over in Europe, because everything was, whatever was good got played.
Yeah.
You know, so we had rock stations, alternative stations, you know, it wasn't as much of a melting pot, but that's what's interesting for me with goth later, because I see things that I'm like, that, why is that getting being called goth? I remember there was kids in like Lamb of God and Metallica shirts all in black, and we're goth. I'm like, huh?
What?
Like, what? Why? You know, and I'd see people, you know, like, or like videos, like goth videos in there. You know, it's these, I don't even know, like cyber trance or something. And,
oh, God. Yeah.
And I'm like, why is this goth? You know, where's, you know, because in my mind, I go back to, you know, that specific era, you know, like they should be, I don't know. But what changed there, you know, in that direction? Or is that even a question? Is it just like, oh, it's just appropriation or something? Like,
I think goth got a little lost in the 2000s.
Yeah, it got hijacked.
That's what I would say. Yeah, and industrial music as well. It was a very bad time for music, the late 90s to the... maybe late 2000s, I would say, is kind of rough.
Yeah. What do you think of these all these new bands? There's some amazing bands that are kind of really paying tribute and being pretty solid. I mean, a lot of them just sound like Zymox, you know, Clan of Zymox. But, you know, when you hear like Drab Majesty or what's that band? She Passed Away. There's some new bands making some pretty interesting music that reminds me of that time. Any of that stuff? Are you getting interested in any of that? Or are you just more interested in the actual stuff from the time?
Oh, no, I'm really into new things. I think I've been thinking about this recently. When I wrote my book, the scene was not as strong as it is today. It's actually grown a whole lot. And when I wrote the conclusion of my book, maybe in 2013, I was kind of making a call to people to, you know, work on your scene. Let's get some new music going. Let's revitalize it. And pretty soon, I think around 2014 is when both the dark synth scene, really, some bands really came out that were so impressive. She Passed Away is one of them. There was this huge resurgence of really great synth, electronic, melodic, Depeche Mode inspired bands.
Yeah.
A ton of them. And it made me really happy. And I think it went on for a few years. But now I'm a little bit scared that there's way too many bands that sound alike.
Yeah.
And it's worrying me a little bit. I'm thinking about how it went in the 80s. Like, everybody wanted to copy The Cure, you know, in the late 80s. And then it just became too much. And it just was so saturated.
Well, yeah, it was like when...
And I'm kind of seeing that happen now.
Yeah, like, that just makes me think of maybe even in the 2000s when Interpol came out. And we were like, hey, they kind of remind me of Joy Division. That's kind of, you know, it's interesting. And then all of a sudden there's like a million bands like that. And you're like, oh, man.
Yeah.
And the whole thing kind of collapsed on itself. But, yeah, no.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, there's some interesting bands, though, coming out. I mean, Drab Majesty, I just saw them recently. And I was just like, wow, this just takes me back when I would go see Zymox at a small club or go see anyone from that generation, you know, or Cocteau Twins or something, even though the music's there. I'm just saying, like, it gave me that feeling again, and I was just like, wow, you know. So there, you put out a synthesized compilation of new bands, right? If I remember correctly. Was that more electronic or a combination of everything?
Definitely. Well, I would say it was mostly tracks. Like, I like to think about songs versus tracks.
Right.
It was very... I emphasized songs or tracks that could be played within a DJ set. So I wanted, you know, a BPM that would work in a DJ set somewhere between, like, 120 and 135, you know.
Right.
And very danceable tracks. One synth wavy song and then an industrial track, and the rest were EBM-ish. So I like it to represent what synthesite is, which is mostly just with the emphasis on synthesizers and dance music. So yeah it was it's good. I have a new one coming out in a couple months, which is very exciting. It took a while to get done, but
very
it's coming.
Cool. Nice. Yeah. And then some non-English speaking bands are on there too, if I recall. Right?
English.
Or they didn't, they were, maybe it wasn't non-English, but bands that were just, wasn't there a couple songs in a different language? Maybe it wasn't that I'm referencing.
No.
Okay, my brain's going somewhere different. But I remember also you talking about just bands from other countries making that music. And, you know, it wasn't in English. I could be confusing it with that. But because there's bands coming out of, like, real small countries, like in Peru or wherever. I think you're in... Don't you know about some of that stuff as well? Am I totally hitting off the mark here?
I think I've written about it. I like to... I like when I hear bands that don't... I wrote an article on Bandcamp. That I was focusing on Detriti Records, which showcases a lot of bands from all around the world.
That's what I'm thinking of. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I remember that, and I've just tripped on my way getting to it, but that's exactly what I was talking about. I remember when you posted that on Twitter or something, and
yeah.
I went and read it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was like post-punk. Post-punk bands from around the world, new things. And I like when that is. I feel like a lot of bands do English lyrics just because you get more popular. I think Exmal Deutschland had a problem with that.
Yeah.
When they were doing their German, they were an amazing band, but they never got the recognition they deserved because they didn't sing in English.
Right.
You know, when they tried that, they kind of. I like all their music, but it wasn't as successful as their previous music that they did in German.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That, I think that's what because there was a couple things you posted I read, but maybe I confused that with the compilation you put out. Cause I just, for some reason it was bands singing in, from other countries and other languages, but some of those mm-hmm. post-punk bands were singing in different languages on that article, right?
Yeah.
Okay, okay, that's what I was confusing it with.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is I had a conversation recently with someone and they were like, who would you compare Depeche Mode to? You know, they're like the Rolling Stones or the Pink Floyds. You know, and I was like, well, that's a fair comparison with, you know, if you want to put it in alternative music. And I came up with one that, I don't know, I'm curious what your thoughts were on this. So I compared them, not musically, but to the Cocteau Twins. And my friend was a little confused. He's like, why would you do that? And I said, you know what's weird and why I do is because whenever I find people who are into them, originally, you know, anyone I knew who even knew who they were people that might have been in like goths or kind of into that music. But nowadays, they have this new resurgence where all these shoegaze bands are like obsessed with them. And then I'm finding friends that were into like metal or punk are all into Cocteau Twins. And I'm like, how is this happening? And there are people that find them. I mean, and they just appeal to everybody. But originally, the only people who'd even mention knowing who they were or even talking about them were people that were into like goth culture or any of the subcultures surrounding it. And I might be way off the mark of projecting my thing of it, but I've just always found, you know, I've been listening to a lot of like the new goth bands, like we mentioned earlier, some of the new shoegaze bands, and they're all obsessed with Cocteau Twins, just like all the new electronic guys are all obsessed with Depeche Mode. And I don't know, who would you compare them to if someone were to ask you that question, like where would you put them? Like maybe it's, I guess, Pink Floyd of alternative, because you can put The Cure and New Order and some of these other bands as like, you know, the hierarchy. But I don't know. I think I don't know where they fit in. I don't even know how to answer that. So you have any thoughts on that?
Well, when you were saying that, I see where you're coming from, but then again, you don't really find bands, not that I know of, that have this fan base of so many dedicated people. There are so many crazy True. Depeche Mode fans. And also, I was thinking about how they infiltrated the DDR. Like, I can't think of another band that kind of was so inspirational to countries like Russia and everybody on the DDR. You know,
what's the DDR?
It's East Germany.
Oh, and, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
The Soviet.
I haven't heard that. I haven't heard that, you know, the occupied area or whatever. I haven't heard it referred to as the DDR before. So sorry, for my ignorance.
Well, they have like, when I was doing research for my book, every Russian was just like, we all love Depeche Mode. And I just can't think of another band that kind of had that sort of crazy effect on everybody that they touched.
Yeah, maybe Metallica or something that had that kind of. Yeah, no, I remember Martin Gore saying, you know, we were, before we could go to Russia, we were, you know, we were second after the Beatles as, you know, one of the most popular bands. And he's like, we couldn't even go there, you know, to see the fans. I guess that's true. Absolutely. I totally agree. I think I just meant, I think my concept for that Cocteau Twins reference was more of just a fitting in thing, you know, mm-hmm. like, I just, but yeah, absolutely. Cause it's insane how big they are. I'm trying to think of any other band that really has that. I mean,
maybe Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, true.
Cause they're very popular and a lot of bands sound like them.
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me, and this is going to really bum some people out. But I'm a Nine Inch Nails fan, the first album mostly. I like a few things after, but they just seemed, at the time, kind of, I don't know, I just thought they were, when they came out, they were kind of like a poppy industrial to me. Like, I thought they were just trying to be Skinny Puppy with more...
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they played with Skinny Puppy, and you find all these things out later, but I just, they never, you know, and then they went really heavy, and I just, but yeah, no, true. I just was making a point that I just thought they were derivative. I don't know. That just seems...
Oh, I agree with you, actually. I'm like, nobody believes me when I say I don't like Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, that first record was amazing. I remember when the Down In It single came out, I was like, that's amazing. But... At the same time, I was like, it's not, why is this so popular? Like, Frontline Assembly's making way better records, or...
I agree.
You know, like, they repeat, I was just like, what, why is this, you know, Trent was obviously talented. I'm not discounting what they've done or do, but I just remember at the time, you know, at that specific time, I was just like, this is good. Why is this blowing up, though? Because you should go listen to... I don't know, Severed Heads or whatever band I was manufacturer, or some band I was listening to at the time. But yeah, it's kind of interesting how that happens. And you know, I don't want to take your whole afternoon here, but I remember when we were kind of talking back and forth on Facebook about this, but we both were kind of fascinated with that Ministry supported Depeche Mode in 82 at the Ritz. And, I mean, I can't even find people online who even went to it, let alone know about it. I was completely floored because that was, you know, with Sympathy era Ministry and Depeche playing together. I mean, have you heard, found out much about that show or anything?
Well, the only thing I could really find, because I tried to do a little bit of looking around on the internet, but the only thing I could see was like this itinerary for Ministry, and it said they performed at Danceteria in the Iroquois a few times, and then it says Depeche Mode at the Ritz. So they played in New York several times, but it's kind of amazing that no photos have showed up, no video. I don't know.
Yeah, I wish there was more on it. There's, you know, there's, and then they played again in 83 in Chicago, I believe. And it's just like, why is there no recordings or photos or how did, I mean, I know both bands weren't what they are today, so maybe it wasn't quite, I just wish there was more evidence of those shows. And, I think it was 83, but I could be wrong, but I know they played in Chicago again with them. And any other, I mean, you know, when it comes to America, you know, it's always Depeche Mode, LA, but they did a lot in New York too. Have you, get any old fans coming up at Synthesize? Just talking about, you know, I remember, you know, being in the booth and you play a song and then some drunk fan comes up and wants to talk to you for 10 minutes about the song you just played. You get much of that going on?
Well, I do, a new wave night where I play a lot of Depeche Mode and stuff. But also there's Depeche Mode dance parties we have here.
Oh yeah.
So
cruises. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
going on
there's
there.
A lot, and I feel like it's a lot of it's people I don't really see. I think it's people that get a babysitter and then come out for the night.
Yeah.
And it's like their one night out of the month.
Yep.
So yeah, I think it's nice here because you have like the 101 people and they'll come out sometimes.
Oh really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they're cool. Chris comes out a lot. He's a great guy. And Jay, he doesn't have social media, but sometimes he'll show up. That's nice. And Liz recently, I met her recently. She's really nice too.
Which one was Liz?
She was the one with the short brown darkish hair.
Oh, the one who was talking about fashion and design and everything.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool that they're still there and still coming out. I see some of them on social media sometimes, but yeah, that's really cool. Were they a part of the did you see the WLIR documentary?
Yeah, I did. No, they weren't.
No. But was Depeche on there much?
I think Vince was.
Interesting.
I can't remember. Maybe I remember Vince on there. And you know, it's funny because Vince lives in Brooklyn as well.
Oh,
so
interesting.
Sometimes I'll run into him at events because his wife is into spooky things like me. So sometimes if I lecture, she's around and.
Oh, cool.
You know, you just kind of run into Depeche Mode related people here in New York. It's interesting.
Yeah. No, a friend of mine ran into Dave on a walk.
Oh, I'm waiting for that day. I'm not sure if I could do it, but I'm waiting for that day.
Yeah, my friend's not a fan on any level. And so he messaged me and he's just like, oh, I ran into that singer of that band you like.
Oh my God.
It just make being as passive aggressive as possible. He's like, no, it was cool. I didn't say anything to him, but I saw him walking around. I was like, oh, that's cool. Yeah.
I really want to see him. It's funny when they were recording, you know, they record in New York. Dave has a studio here. Right. So there's often Depeche Mode sightings and some like crazed out Depeche Mode fans will message me and be like, did you find them? I'm like, I'm not going around the city looking for them, you know?
Oh no. Yeah. People are like, can you confirm this map? Is this where people were?
Oh, people do that to me before. They're like, will you go to Dave's condo and like get an autograph? I'm like, absolutely not. No. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, no, it's, I know that has become something. I knew people would be obsessed with the band, but until social media, I didn't realize how obsessed. I just thought you collected magazines and records and posters and stuff, not like, you know, where they were on October 4th at 3:15. Like, whoa, all right.
It's scary. Yeah, honestly, I think the fan takeover was an interesting thing, but I think the one thing I took away from that is that Depeche Mode has some really crazy fans.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to mention we were both Facebook takeoveries or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. How was your experience with that?
The day was fun. I had a lot of fun. It was nice talking about Depeche Mode all day, but I think just seeing some, like we have, I don't know if we're allowed to say, but we, you know, we have like this closed Facebook group for everybody who was on the talk, but I mean, you know, there's very different levels of obsessions and some I just never fathomed in my life.
Yeah, I know. It's like I talk to people like I'm obsessed with the music. I couldn't even tell you Martin Gore's kids' names, you know, but then I know people who can tell you their birth dates and their astrological signs and where they were on their 10th birthday. I'm like, dude, all right, that's cool. Do you have this obscure remix? I'm more interested in that, you know, but you know, but I at the same time, I'm kind of like, that's pretty cool to know that.
I mean, that's the one thing I took away from it is that there are people out. I thought I was obsessed, but there are people out there way beyond anything I could imagine.
Yeah. It's interesting. The, now, you know, I know your book, Somewhere Leather, Somewhere Lace, we've referenced a few times here when we're talking, but it came out a few years ago, but is it still available?
Yeah, you can just look it up on Amazon. Yeah, you should get it soon if anybody's trying to. There's only a limited, It's on its second pressing. I'm not sure if they're going to press another round.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. But I think that it's on its last, you know, I don't know how many copies are left. I know that it's been selling pretty well, but it's a few years old. I'm working on a new book now. So,
Hopefully
that will be out soonish.
When we get there. I remember, you know, during the press time of it, you were doing a lot of lectures. And so how'd you get into lecturing? Is that boring to talk about? Or it's kind of fascinating for me how you,
lectures.
Well, no, I mean,
actually, it's funny though, because when growing up, I had social anxiety and I couldn't leave my bedroom. Basically, it was very hard. And I think lecturing is kind of something I do to fight the battle in my head of that social anxiety. And plus, I really love, it's interesting because, yeah, you have DJ nights and that's a certain thing. But then when you do a lecture, you have people there who are ready to learn and are truly fans, and they like to give input. They like to ask questions, and I really love interacting with people. I think that's what's really special about lectures.
Have you had any interesting moments trying to convey what, you know, to people that are completely, it's completely foreign, like they just think goth is some, I don't know, devil thing, or, you know, have you tried to explain the subcultures to people and had any interesting reactions?
Usually those types of people don't pay to get into the lecture.
That's true. I guess maybe during maybe the press tour, you know, discussing the book and any casual people coming in, just, I don't know. It's always interesting. I remember growing up and having friends that were into it, or punk rock friends, and just some of the, I mean, nowadays so many things are so just, everything's kind of cool. But I mean, when I was in high school and there was like two of us that were into anything, it was not cool. Like, I remember in the mornings helping my friend put his mohawk up, you know, and you'd go to school and it would just be like, you know, now it's like there's, you go watch 5-year-olds play soccer and 3/4 of them have mohawks, you know. It's just so, it's come so far. Green Day has a musical, you know. It's like, what?
What? I didn't know about this.
Yeah, I don't know if they still do, but, you know, like how far punk rock and everything. But I could just curious if you had strangers coming up like, I had no idea about this. And I really, you know, or from your book, you know, people that just outside of the world, have you had anyone coming up just telling you I'm really interested in it now? Have you converted people, I guess?
Yeah, I think there's been some young people who are kind of like, oh, I like, you know, I like The Cure, or I like spooky things, and then they come and they like to ask questions like, oh, what bands should I start out with? Like, what are the albums that I can introduce myself to, or what books can I learn about? And I really love that. I just want to educate people about what goth really is, because it's so misconstrued these days, and it's just a disaster. And it's so easy to just find information on the internet that's not real or not, you know. It's kind of,
well, you know what floored,
you can just find stuff.
Yeah, you know what floored me that I had no idea that existed until I watched your Q&A online, is that the Sisters of Mercy and Black Flag played together in New York at the Ritz. I was like, I don't know if you remember, you guys were talking about that, but I was like, I would have never thought a promoter would put those two bands together. Like, I guess it makes sense, but do you recall that?
No, I recall Sisters of Mercy playing with Gang of Four and what's that rap group? What is the rap group? They did a tour with
It'll come to you. Oh, yeah. Was it Public Enemy?
Yeah, Public Enemy.
Oh, how did that pop in my... Wow, okay.
I wrote about that. I wrote an article on that, and that's super surprising to me.
Was that here in the States, or was that in...
Yeah.
I vaguely remember that. I remember seeing that like on 120 Minutes going, why are those bands playing together? Like, what?
Yeah, and it was Gang of Four as well.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that was a time of some interesting shows. No, you were doing a Q&A in a record store with a couple other people about the book, and they were talking about that Sisters of Mercy and Black Flag playing at the Ritz, and I just kind of went, wow, that just floored me. I had no idea that. But I guess at the time it made sense because it was such a small scene, you know, just let's bring the two together, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think the Public Enemy pairing was that. I think Andrew Eldritch was very upset with the turnout of that tour.
Oh, really?
And kind of angry at Americans for being, for not liking his lineup.
Well, yeah, that's, I vaguely remember the tour, but I haven't heard anything about the reaction. But yeah, I mean, it kind of floored me hearing that they played with Depeche Mode a couple gigs, you know. I just didn't, at the time, you know, I was talking to my friend David, and I was like, you know, here in the States, we always had pop bands opening, you know, Book of Love, Animotion, all this whatever. Mm-hmm. And then in Europe, they had industrial bands, Portion Control and different things, and, you know, 242, whatever. And then, you know, Crystal Palace, and a couple other times after, but I was like, Sisters of Mercy? Like, I just didn't, I guess that means, I don't know, but like earlier I was saying it made sense they'd be together, but I guess at the time it didn't. So I made no point at all.
Well, you know what's interesting? I saw half of a Sisters of Mercy show. It got cut off early because the fog machine was like a fire hazard, so they shut down the whole show. But
oh,
a Cure cover band opened for Sisters of Mercy. It was...
Wow.
Now think about that. It was just a guy with a big, like, Robert Smith hairstyle wig on playing Cure songs.
How did Sisters even agree to that?
I have no idea, but they only played about 6 songs, and I was very upset. Like, the lights just came on, they said show over. I was like, it was in Richmond, Virginia, so It was very strange.
Okay, I've got a strange ones for you. I went to see Peter Murphy in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And we're looking at the ticket stub, and the opening is Jewel. We're like, who's Jewel?
About that.
And so my friend Mike and I go to the show, and then she comes out and she starts singing, and we're like, what is this? And then she starts yodeling.
Oh my god.
And we're like looking at each other, we're like, what in the fuck? And then and then she goes, I'm gonna be Dolores O'Riordan from the Cranberries and yodel like her. And my friend just got up and walked out. And I just sat there going, what am I watching? And then, like, Peter Murphy comes out, and, you know, it's a great Peter Murphy set. But, yeah, that was an obscure thing. But it was kind of before she was Jewel. And, yeah, it was weird. I saw an interview with her, and she was like, oh, I opened for Bauhaus once. But it was just Peter Murphy. But I was just like, what the hell? Yeah, my friend was like, I can't do this. I'm out of here. And I just, for whatever reason, maybe to punish myself, I sat there and was just like, there's got to be something good here. Like, no, this is terrible. Just
like, yeah, that she must have pulled some strings for that one. I have no idea.
Yeah, or maybe just the promoter. Just she filled in for. No, she was on the ticket. Yeah, she was on the posters and everything. It was, I can't even remember. It was like the mid-90s, like his Cascade album, or is that, I can't remember the name.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, it was interesting. So lecturing.
Yeah,
lecturing.
She was kind of popular in like 1996, 97, right? That's when she had a big hit.
Well, when she blew up, we were like, oh my god, she opened for Peter Murphy. You know, we were like, now she's like all over TV and VH1 or whatever. We were just kind of tripping out. But yeah, that was, yeah. But I know it's like finding that, that's how I was when I found out Sisters opened for Depeche. I was like, what? And then there's this great interview beforehand where Martin Gore he was talking about, he was more interested in the other openers, and when the guy asked him about Sisters, he was like, like he couldn't say, yeah, they're cool. Like, he's just like,
I mean, I can't say many good things about openers, honestly.
No, we've had terrible ones. Like,
yeah,
we never get good ones here. I mean, Knights of Reb was amazing, Book of Love. But then we had a stretch.
Yeah, in the 80s, but not since in the 2000s. No. So it's been really bad.
That's what I was going to say. That was when it kind of ended. I mean, I remember in Stabbing Westward. I don't know if you're a fan. People seem. I just was like, oh, man, I'd skip them every time. I mean, they toured twice. And then we had Poe. Like, what?
What is I going? Remember like a Bjorn and John or
yeah, Peter
something?
Bjorn and John. Yeah, yeah. That was 2009. Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked a song or two, so maybe a little bit of a guilty pleasure there. But yeah, I skipped their set. But yeah, I mean, I guess. Oh, what's that band? She Wants Revenge? They were.
Oh, did they open for
here on the West Coast?
Not over here.
He had the Bravery, I think, on the East Coast. And then, yeah, and then it was
Bravery, yeah.
Yeah, and then they had a handful of songs, but yeah, it's like, and then we get Poe, and then in Europe they had Fad Gadget, you know, like, oh, God. Or they'd have, like, Knights of Reb again, and we'd get.
I know.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess here it just didn't really, I mean, I did like, a few of the bands recently, but it's not like that same caliber, you know.
Yeah. So I would just like to hear Martin's DJ sets. Honestly, like, I love his DJs. It's like a thing I look forward to is just hearing his DJ sets every show.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had an interesting conversation on a message board where people are just like, I hate the remixes. They destroy the remix, but I gotta know every song in his DJ sets. And it's like half of them did the remixes of the singles. It's just like, I remember just kind of having a chuckle of that. But yeah, I had a weird, there was a guy who I used to DJ with, and randomly we got talking, and I was telling him I was a big fan, and he ended up being roommates with a guy who did a remix for Depeche. And his name was Kid 606. And he made like glitch, like crazy in the late 90s, early 2000s, all that cut up glitch techno.
Oh.
Yeah. And then he remixed Dream On, the first single off Exciter. And I was like, are you serious? He goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, that was his biggest thing he did. You know, he's basically, you know, he had some obscure, but it was when it was like really like, I don't know. His music was interesting, but it was kind of like, yeah, but they would use these obscure people, and then they would be in the DJ sets, and they'd be like, oh, I love the DJ sets. Those remixes suck. Like, what? So, I mean, I get people want the old 12-inch versions, but, you know. Well, that's really cool. Well, I don't want to take up your whole time here. I just thank you so much. I guess we should start wrapping this up. I could talk music forever. I don't want to bore you with that
too.
Either.
It's not boring to me. That's all I want to do, honestly.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we could do this again and just talk about bands.
Like, yeah, hey. Let's do it.
Well, you know, it's funny. One thing I meant I touched on a little bit, but I didn't get back to it. But it's amazing how much influence Depeche took from that whole big punk, post-punk umbrella. You know, even though they talk about... you know, the glam era, you know, Bowie and Mark Bolan and all that. But I do think they were, you know, I'd be fascinated. If I could go back in time, I would love to see those days and see what bands they were going. Did they go see Joy Division? You know, Dave, you know, did they go see Visage? And I don't know. Just that whole, I guess those, it's interesting when you watch that Synth Britannica. Did you watch that documentary?
Yeah, it's great.
And I love how they kind of mentioned, like, we are over here and they were over there and they're all kind of working independently of each other. There wasn't basically a scene. So I was like, maybe Cabaret Voltaire, like, what was inspiring in them? You know, because, you know, I see Depeche talk about, oh, we love Mute Records and Fad Gadget and we loved Silicon Teens and The Normal, but they didn't make music that sounded anything like it, you know? I was like, how did they get on that bill? And how did, you know, it was so different. But I guess it was at the time, it was just all electronic.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, would you consider Depeche Mode post-punk?
Yes. I mean, in the same way that you would say Soft Cell is post-punk.
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
I think their approach was... One thing about post-punk is that they took the DIY aspect of
definitely.
Punk and put it into their own thing. And that's definitely what Depeche Mode did. They're very DIY.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. I was a friend and I are talking about working on this project, and we're like, the early days, I'm like, I wonder if their parents helped them buy those keyboards or, but did their moms go to the show? Like, I started thinking about all the different things, like, man, like, did they steal those milk crates from behind the grocery store? Like, I start wanting to know all the minutia, like, the under minutia, like.
Yes.
Like, who picked out their outfits, you know? Like, I don't know. But, you know, because you see things like photos of the New Romantics at, like, the Blitz kids from the Blitz Club, and you see all that. It's like, you know, recently we got into a music conversation on Facebook, and Daryl Bamonte who worked with the band for years and years. And and I asked him what Crocs, you know, he was like, oh, they were playing these songs at Crocs, the legendary Crocs clubs that Depeche was going to. And I asked him, I was like, you know, what kind of thing? And he goes, it was basically the Studio 64. You know, you would hear more disco, but they would have futurist nights. Because in my mind, I picture Crocs being Fad Gadget Depeche Mode 24/7. Turns out it was just a disco and they had a night. But I would love to kind of go back to those post-punk days, and just so many, you know, Bernard Sumner was saying that Love Will Tear Us Apart was kind of like their beginning of electronic music. And that was kind of the last present that Ian gave them before he died. And, you know, they were exploring, he was bringing Kraftwerk records to Joy Division rehearsals and playing, you know, Iggy Pop and Kraftwerk. And I was just like, so much was happening. I guess that's why post-punk's such a big umbrella. I mean, it just covers so many, you know, from the synth pop to, you know, Joy Division. It's just, you know, it's hard to put like somebody like, I don't know, Howard Jones in there, but I guess, you know, he was influenced by that and was making all synth music, and I don't know. Now I'm overthinking it and losing my point, so I'm going to shut up here. But
you should definitely read that book, Rip It Up and Start Again.
Yeah, who Rip It Up and Start Again by who?
Simon Reynolds.
Simon Reynolds. Okay, I'm going to go look that up. And your book, Somewhere Leather, Somewhere Lace, is specifically on 80s goth and post-punk.
Yep,
and that's available, so people go look for that. I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you so much for coming and hanging out and chatting with me here on the podcast.
Hopefully, thank you.
As I stumble over this, hopefully we got some good stuff in there. Well, despite my shortcomings here as an interviewer, I'd like to thank Andy for hanging in there with me on this episode of the podcast. A few talking points aside, I generally just like to leave my interviews kind of open so it can be more of a natural conversation, but that always, of course, causes me to kind of stumble as thoughts are bouncing around in my head and I'm trying to keep the conversation moving along. So thanks, Andy, for being so patient with me here, and I wouldn't have blamed you in the slightest for hanging right up on me, so thanks again. For more information on Andy, please visit andyharriman.com and be sure to follow her on Twitter at Andy with an I. If you have any thoughts or anything you'd like to share with me, drop me an email. That's Glenn, G-L-E-N, at depeche-mode.com. For more information on the podcast, be sure to follow me on all the usual suspects. It's at Breathe In Fumes on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And be sure to subscribe on iTunes or Google or YouTube. And Echo Dot users, just ask Alexa to play the Breathing In Fumes podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I'll have a new episode up here real soon. Take care, everyone.